Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with The Love Triangle Resolved. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. We have seen that the Song of Solomon is written in the form of a drama in five acts. And it tells a story about a love triangle between a country girl from Shulam, her country boy lover to whom she is betrothed, and King Solomon, who tries to steal her away from her betrothed lover. And in it, we see an example of the kind of love and loyalty we should have toward God and of the kind of love he has for us. Last time, we had seen that our heroine had just faced off with Solomon, who had tempted her with the pride of life by offering her perhaps the top queen spot, and then with the lust of the flesh by simply trying to entice her with fleshly pleasure. However, she stood firm against the temptation and finally played her trump card and told him that right under his nose, her shepherd had sneaked into his court and she had consummated her marriage with her betrothed shepherd. Remember, betrothal was the legally binding ceremony, and generally the couple would come together and be married once both their families agreed they were ready. But, of course, their families weren't there, and she had gotten permission from the only adults who were there, some of the courtiers who were sympathetic, and they had consummated their marriage under Solomon's roof. Well, Solomon had been foiled. He had not realized this was going to happen, and as long as they were betrothed and not married, he could procure a divorce from her family. And her brothers were in charge, remember, they weren't that sympathetic toward her. He was probably hoping to get her betrothal divorced, because remember, betrothal being legally binding, he needed a divorce to break it, even though you weren't married yet, you hadn't consummated it. Well, until you consummated it, the families could call for a divorce. But once the marriage was consummated, then only the husband could divorce, and of course the shepherd wasn't about to do that. So Solomon was foiled, and he had probably exited in great anger. And this poor country girl, who marriageable age was about 15 at the time, so she's probably about 15, she just defied the king. He just stormed out in fury, and she's left nervously alone, anticipating what is going to happen to her. And she speaks in Song of Solomon 7, verse 11, and says, "Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages." Now, I don't think that her beloved is actually there. He wasn't waiting in the next room and came back in once Solomon left. They probably didn't trust what would happen after they consummated their relationship. She probably told him to flee, to go out into the field, someplace where she could meet him if she got let go, and not be around for Solomon to get revenge on him once he discovered what had happened. So I think she's speaking to her absent beloved, imagining he was there, trying to calm herself down by doing this, saying, "Let us go forth to the field, let us lodge in the villages." That's what she really wanted to do. She didn't want to be in Jerusalem anymore. She didn't want to be a queen living in a palace. She wanted to be in the fields and lodging in the country villages with her beloved shepherd. Verse 12, "Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love." So she wants to be lodging in the country and getting up early to go into the vineyards. Remember, her family were grape growers, so she was very familiar with vineyards. And she wanted to see if the vines are budding, if their blossoms are opening, if the grapes are appearing, and then if the pomegranates are in bloom. Now remember, she was doing this when Solomon had found her. She had gone into a nut garden, but there were grapevines and pomegranates there, and she was looking at the nuts and the pomegranates and the grapevines, seeing if they were in bloom and the pretty flowers. And she didn't know it, but Solomon had stopped off to walk through that same beautiful garden, and that's where he had come upon her and fallen for her, quite to her dismay, because of course she was in love with her shepherd and didn't want to marry the king. But she wants to do this with her shepherd beloved, go to these gardens that she loves to be in the country. And she says, "There I will give you my love." Now it's actually loves in Hebrew, plural, and we don't speak of plural loves, so we would probably say endearments. "There I will give you my endearments." Verse 13, "The mandrakes give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits. all manner, new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. She speaks of the mandrakes giving off a fragrance. Now remember, she has already seen the house that her shepherd is building for the two of them once they get married. And of course, now they are married, now they'll go and live in that house. So she says there are mandrakes there, but this could also be a reference to the fact that mandrakes are thought to promote fertility. Remember in the story of Jacob's wives, Leah and Rachel, Leah had some mandrakes and Rachel wanted them because Leah was having children. Rachel was having problems with fertility, and so she wanted the mandrakes. So maybe she's speaking, anticipating them having children, she and her shepherd. And at their gates will be pleasant fruits. Maybe she's thinking of those children they're going to have. But remember, she has also compared herself to a garden with fruits. And she says of these fruits that they're all manner, new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. So they've already consummated their relationship. They're right under Solomon's nose. But her fruit is laid up for him, whether it's old or whether it's new. Her fruit belongs to him. And she hasn't given any of her fruit to King Solomon. Now continuing here with Act 4 in chapter 8 and verse 1. Oh, that you were like my brother, who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I should find you outside, I would kiss you. I would not be despised. Now she is on a bit of an emotional roller coaster here as she's waiting to find out what's going to happen. And here I think she starts to despair. Think, oh, Solomon will never let me go. I'll never see my beloved shepherd again. What will I do? And she says, if only he was my brother. If only he had nursed at my own mother's breasts. In other words, he was my brother. Because she says, then if I should find you outside, I would kiss you. So she says, a sister, she could walk right up to her brother, right in the street, and kiss him. Now, there is no way a woman could do that with just any man. And certainly if she's forced to marry Solomon, she couldn't walk up and kiss a man who wasn't her husband, who wasn't King Solomon. Nobody would allow that. But if he was her brother, well, she could do it. She could walk up to him, kiss him in the street, wouldn't be despised for it, because after all, it was her brother, her full brother. And so she could kiss him in the street, wouldn't be despised. Whereas, of course, as it is, if she is forced to marry Solomon, she won't be able to kiss him or acknowledge him or even talk to him. Have a relationship with him at all. So she says, if only he was my brother. Verse 2, I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to instruct me. I would cause you to drink of spiced wine, of the juice of my pomegranate. So in this theoretical, fictitious reality where he was her brother, she would be able to lead her brother and bring him into the house of her mother. And she could be with him. She could never do that, of course, if he's a man unrelated to her and she's married to someone else. She couldn't be bringing him into the house of her mother with her. She who used to instruct me. Now, the translation here is a bit questionable. It's hard to say in the Hebrew whether it's the mother who's going to instruct or whether it's actually he, her shepherd, who she wants to instruct her. And assuming he's a few years older than she is, which would be typical for the time, typically a woman would marry a man a few years older. Maybe she's anticipating him instructing her. But I would note here that this is really kind of a rather childish and despairing wish she's having here. Because, let's be honest, she doesn't want to have a sisterly relationship with her shepherd. No, she wants him to be her lover. That's what she wants. But as I said, she is despairing here. And she's afraid she won't be able to have a relationship with him at all if the powerful King Solomon gets his way. So she's saying, I would rather you are my brother and I could have a relationship with you than not getting to have one at all. So she says, oh, if only you were my brother. But that's not what she really wants. She says, I would cause you to drink of spiced wine of the juice of my pomegranate. So she's anticipating being able to serve him. She won't be able to serve him, do anything for him, if she's forced to marry Solomon. But she could serve him if he was her brother. Now, pomegranate juice, that's not so common in our society. But they loved it in that part of the world, very common. They very much liked the taste of pomegranate juice. And so she was going to give him spiced wine and pomegranate juice in her theoretical. But her despairing wish starts to break down because, like I said, she doesn't really want to be his sister. She wants to be his lover. So verse 3, she says, his left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. So she forgets all about the brother-sister idea and goes back to them being lovers and his left hand under her head, his right hand embracing her. Well, at this point, it seems, she has been alone like I said, trembling and weak and afraid, probably sunk down into a chair with her knees weak, after dismissing Solomon, after he rushes out probably in a rage. And now the court ladies start to file in. They've gotten their instructions from Solomon, and before they can speak or do anything, she talks to them and says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until she pleases." She's personifying love there, not it, but she. She says, "Don't try to stir up my love for Solomon when I don't want my love to go to Solomon. I want it to go to my shepherd." Now she says this. She said this before. It's been a familiar refrain with her. It's a little abbreviated here. Maybe she's rushed, or maybe we've reached the climax of the situation, or maybe the court ladies are in a hurry. Don't let her get the full thing out. But what happens at this point? Well, at this point, I think there can be no doubt about it, but that Solomon apparently dismisses her. And I think he realizes at this point that he has been foiled. That if she was betrothed, he could have finagled a divorce for her out of her family. But once she is actually married, she's consummated her relationship and she's married to her shepherd, well, he realizes he's fooled. He can't do anything about it. And even as the king, of course, you know what happened with David, with Bathsheba, he realizes that he can't force the issue. And the Lord won't put up with adultery, so he has no choice but to let her go. But I doubt he lets her go with honor. Now, he has clothed her in beautiful clothing and loaded her down with beautiful jewelry. Well, I think he probably took all those things back. Now, not him personally, I'm sure. He probably had his court ladies do it. But I doubt he told them to be gentle about it. You know, they probably ripped the clothes off of her and ripped the jewelry off of her, you know, ripped the earrings out of her ears or whatever. I don't think they took them off nicely and said, "Oh, is that okay, dear?" No. I think he probably said, "Be rough about it." And then he probably had his soldiers drag her out, you know, throw her out the back door, treat her like a common whore or something. Maybe make some cruel and lewd jokes as they're carrying her out. You know, maybe throw her out the back door, maybe give her a kick in the rear as they send her out the door. Maybe shove her into a mud puddle as they throw her out. And so they send her out in shame. But if they threw her out to the ground, I think she probably kissed the ground. Why? Well, because though she might have been shamed in the eyes of the king's court, in her eyes, she has been set free. And this is what she wanted more than anything, is to be able to go back to her shepherd love. So she has won, and Solomon lost. And so the love triangle is resolved. She will be able to go back to her beloved shepherd. Well, that's the end of Act 4. Now we have the final act, Act 5, starting in Song of Solomon, chapter 8, and verse 5. "Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. There she who bore you brought you forth." What do we have here? Well, here I think we have the citizens of her hometown. And they are looking out and seeing her returning from the wilderness. No doubt from the direction of Jerusalem, wherever Shulam was. Like I said, we don't know where Shulam was. But wherever it was, she had to cross the wilderness to return from Jerusalem. And they see her coming. Now she is coming with her beloved. So here she is, the new bride returning home, or to her new home. Now compare this to chapter 3. Remember there, Solomon was returning from one of his many weddings with his new bride. And remember, the Jerusalemites were seeing him coming. And what were they noticing? Well, they were noticing the rich perfumes. You can almost smell Solomon's cavalcade before you could see them. There was so much rich perfume. They noticed his beautiful palanquin, his sedan chair that he was riding in. They noticed his majestic honor guard with their swords at their sides, marching alongside him. They noticed the beautiful crown that was on Solomon's head, the new crown he had just received from his mother. They noticed everything but the new bride. No one cared about the new bride. Because Solomon had made new brides so common, new queens so common, that it was like bringing home a new cow to bring home a new bride. Nobody cared. But when this girl returns home, what do the people notice? Do they notice her rich perfume? No, she and her shepherd aren't wearing rich perfumes. Do they notice their palanquin, their sedan chair? No, they aren't riding a sedan chair, they're walking. Do they notice their honor guard? No, they don't have an honor guard. Or if they do, it's probably a shepherd friend's or maybe a sheep. No majestic honor guard. Do they notice the beautiful crowns they're wearing? No, they aren't wearing crowns, unless they've made them for themselves of flowers. No, they don't notice these things. What do they notice? They notice her. They notice the girl. They notice the happy new bride. They notice what everyone should notice when they see a just married couple, when they see a new bride. They notice the bride. And that's the way it should be. But that's not the way it was with Solomon, because he had made marriage into a joke. But she's coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved. And oh, how happy the two of them must have been. Now she speaks to him and says, I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. There she who bore you brought you forth. So it seems that he had actually been born under an apple tree. Now this would not have been too uncommon in Israel. In our society, people are generally born in hospitals. But realize that back then, giving birth was a process that made you unclean. So any room that you gave birth in, well, the room would have to be cleansed. It would make the room unclean. So if it was a warm time of the year, it would be much more convenient to give birth outside. And that way you wouldn't have to worry about making a room unclean. And if it was a warmer month of the year, of course, you'd want to do it in the shade. You'd want to do it under a tree. So he had apparently been born under an apple tree. And lo and behold, she had actually raised love in his heart. He had actually fallen in love with her under this very same tree. Now, it says apple tree in our translations, as I've told you before. This might be an orange tree. It's hard to say from the Hebrew. It's hard to identify. Now, we have a saying in our society when you talk about apples and oranges as being two completely different things. So it's kind of funny to say this could have been an apple tree or an orange tree. But understand they're both fruit trees. They're not really that different in spite of our figure of speech there. But I guess we'll just say apple tree because we don't really know. But how did this happen? Does this mean she was just out in the fields running around like she loved to do and he happened to be there under the apple tree, maybe feeding a sheep, and they ran into each other and fell in love? That's how we would think of it. But I think we're maybe showing that we're chowder-headed Westerners who don't understand how things work in most of the world if we think that. See, I think this probably went more like this. She was a young girl, hadn't hit puberty yet, maybe 10, 11, 12 years old, pretty young. And her father comes home one day and says, call little Shuli. I'll call her Shuli because she's the Shulamite. Of course, that wasn't really her name, I'm sure. She wasn't named after her town. But of course, we don't know what her name was. It could have been Rachel, Hannah, Rebecca. I don't know. Could have been any good Hebrew name. But we'll call her Shuli for want of a better name. He says, call little Shuli. And he says, little Shuli, I have a surprise for you. He says, I have arranged your marriage. I found the man you're going to marry. Of course, little Shuli is all excited. Now, he might have arranged this. She might be the first one of all her friends her own age to get betrothed. And I think that's because she's the youngest child of the family. Her father is maybe getting old and in not such good health. We realize that before she even hit puberty, her father was dead and her brothers were in charge of the family, according to what we read later. So maybe he was in poor health and thought, I better get this marriage arranged while I still can. So she might be the first one of her friends to get her marriage arranged, or maybe some of her older friends have been betrothed, and she's excited. She's betrothed now. And she says, well, who is it? And he explains, well, it's this family who there are old friends of mine or acquaintances of mine, and they're basically the same social status, the same economic status, more or less, as we are, but they live in a different town, so they're a good match. And he's their youngest child, just like you're my youngest daughter, so it's a good match there, so it's a good match for you. So she maybe asks, what's their family business? Because this is the family business she's going to be married into. She loves the country. She loves the outdoors. So she probably is hoping she's not marrying a clerk or something. She says, maybe, are they vineyard keepers like we are? Of course, she loves the beautiful flowers and the plants. She's hoping for an outdoor type of husband. He says, no, they aren't vineyard keepers. They are shepherds. Well, she's happy with that. Shepherds, that's a good outdoor type of business. So she's fine with that. Sounds great. And so she says, when is the betrothal ceremony going to be? And where is it going to be? He probably says, well, it's at such and such a time, maybe a few weeks or months later. And he says, we are going to have it over at their town. And we're going to have it. We actually arranged it. And maybe I see a bit of the hand of the groom's mother in this. And we arranged it that we're going to have your betrothal ceremony under the very same apple tree where he was born, where his mother gave birth to him. And she probably thinks, oh, that's romantic. Any young girl would. So the weeks or months, the time goes by, and the day comes. And they all get together, and their family and friends from Shulam get together. And they go marching off the journey to this nearby town, where they're going to have the betrothal ceremony. And her brothers are maybe teasing her and saying, oh, he's probably going to be ugly and have just one tooth. Of course, she's never seen him before, so they're teasing her. And she is trying to act calm, cool, and collected. But of course, she's all nervous and excited. And what's he going to be like? And so they get to the town. And she says to her father, Daddy, who is he? Point him out to me. Because she sees a bunch of young boys there and wants to know which one is him. And he's there with his friends, and he's maybe the youngest child, so he's there with his older siblings, and they've probably been teasing him and saying, she'll probably be ugly and have just one tooth. So he's there, and he's probably older than 12. He's a few years older than she is. And remember, in the Jewish society, you're an adult at 12 years old. And he's probably feeling a lot like an adult now. Of course, he's getting betrothed. So he's trying to act all calm and grown up, and like this is no big deal. And really, he's all excited and nervous, because of course it is a big deal. But there he is, and her father points him out to her. There he is. There's the man you're going to marry. And oh, she looks at him, and he is handsome, isn't he? And she's suddenly all shy. But her mother maybe says to her, go up to him, you know, meet him. You got to meet him. You're going to marry him. You're about to go through the betrothal ceremony, so you've got to meet him. So she goes up to him shyly, and he sees her coming, and oh, here's the girl he's going to marry. And oh, she is a cute little girl. She is a pretty little girl, isn't she? And so she speaks to him, and he speaks to her, and he is quite impressed by her, and she raises, at that point, she raises love in his heart. Just with a few things they say to each other there, they stand together under the canopy in front of whoever's doing the marriage ceremony. Of course, they didn't have rabbis at the time. That was later Jewish culture, but maybe it was a priest, an Aaronic or a Levitical priest, or maybe their fathers did it. I don't know who ran the ceremony in their culture at the time. But just from meeting each other there and going through the ceremony, he falls in love with her. And she with him. And so maybe she and her family are on their way back home, and she says, oh, Daddy, he was wonderful. Thank you for arranging such a good marriage for me. So her father and mother tell her, well, little Shuli, not now that you're engaged, now that you're betrothed, here's what you have to do. You have to get ready. You have to learn from your mother all the household tasks you'll need to know to be a wife, how to cook and how to clean and how to raise children. And you'll have to go to some of the shepherds' wives in our town and learn from them about taking care of sheep, because, of course, we know nothing about it. We don't have any sheep. And then we're going to give you a gift of your own little vineyard when you get married, just like his family is going to give him a gift of a few sheep to start his own flock. Well, he's not going to know anything about grapes because, of course, his family aren't into grapes, so you've got to learn everything you can about vineyard keeping. So when your wedding time comes, you'll be ready to be married. And that's how it probably happened. That's how they fell in love under the apple tree where he had been born. And not, like I said, in our culture where they would just happen to meet there. No. But at the same time, this isn't so completely non-romantic as we like to make it out. We always make out that only choosing your own partner is romantic and being engaged by your parents is not romantic. Well, I don't know. I think it could be romantic, and I think it was quite romantic here. But then verse 6, she says, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. So she tells him to set her like a seal upon his heart. Now understand this seal, I believe that what this was the signet ring. And we have to realize that in their culture, most people couldn't write. So you couldn't sign your name to a legal document like we could now because you couldn't write. So they would generally carry a signet ring, and that signet ring would have a special seal on it that was your seal. It was the seal of you. And so when you would seal a document with that signet ring, that would be like your signature. It would be your seal. So it identified you. Now she says, set me like a signet ring on your heart. Rather than on your arm, rather than on your finger, set me like a ring on your heart. Sealing me so that your heart belongs to me. So that I am like the signet ring on your heart. I'm identified with you. And then she says, for love is as strong as death. What does this mean? How strong is death? Well, compare it to illness. You know, illness gets a hold of you, maybe you shake it off. Maybe a bad illness gets a hold of you. And you still manage to shake it off. Or maybe if it's chronic, you at least manage to keep living with it. It has a grasp on you, but not completely. But death is different. Once death gets a hold of you, it dominates you. And it doesn't let you go. Once you're dead, death doesn't let you go. And the same thing's true of love. She says, love, once it gets a hold of you, once true love gets a hold of you, it never lets you go. No, infatuation comes and goes. But real love, God's type of love, is as strong as death. It never lets you go. So we see in this portion that the faithfulness of the Shulamite to her shepherd paid off when she was released from Solomon's court and allowed to go back home with him. She, the happy bride, is what everyone sees when she comes back to her home, leaning on the arm of her beloved shepherd husband. Do we too believe in the strength of love? Would we agree with this young girl that real love is better than the things that Solomon offered, riches and glory and sexual pleasure? That real love is better? Well, I pray that we do. We believe in God's type of real love.
The country girl returns home after being tempted by Solomon with all of the pleasures this world can offer. We too can remain faithful to the Lord, the one who should always be our first love. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the love triangle resolved. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with the Lord's Fire. Thank you for joining us today. We trust that you are learning that the more we study God's Word, the more we can know God. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. We'll say so long for now, but we will look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.